Our opening words this morning will be provided by Barb Park.
These are taken from a book called The Larger Faith by Charles Howe. In September 4th, 1793, a group of people who called themselves Universalists gathered in the village of Oxford, Massachusetts for a day of preaching, prayer, fellowship, mutual support, and organizational business. Those present called their meeting a general convention of the Universalist churches and societies in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, and New York. The Reverend John Murray was their moderator, and the only record of the proceedings is a circular letter written by him on behalf of those who attended. Although they could not have known it at the time, their meeting marked the beginning of a new denomination that would survive for 168 years until it united with the Unitarians in 1961. Okay, we're going to start with, you have a packet of hymns on your, somewhere on the pew is there. Thick packet. And we're going to be singing the first one. Now this program is based on a program that was done at General Assembly in Alberta, Canada, in Calgary, on June 28, 1992. Out of this, and so I've got the proceedings of this, singing, shouting, celebrating. And so all of the things that we do today are going to be based on this program. And we'll do a lot of singing, and we'll do a little bit of connecting explanations. So if you want to stand as you're willing and able, and we'll sing this first hymn that was written by Hosea Blue for the General Convention of 1808.
Please welcome Lynn Pavelski and Jill to do our chalice lighting.
This is by the same author of the song we just sang, Hosea Ballou, who's an early Universalist preacher and leader. If we agree in love, there is no disagreement that can do us any injury. But if we do not, no other agreement can do us any good. Let us endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace.
Thank you. Thank you so much. A few weeks ago, Reverend Kalen Fristad presented a brief history of Universalist thought down through the history of Christianity. At that program, Rose Smith read us the story of John Murray, the moderator at that first meeting, and how he came from England to America, discouraged and despondent after the death of his wife and child, and determined not to preach the Universalist message again. Today for the children's story, we're going to hear about another one of who they called the dissenters, people who were in a group of various churches that did not agree with the Church of England, and the government was really squashing their dissent in the early 1890s. Rather than the story that's in the bulletin, we're going to read Rosemary is going to read a different one entitled The Minister Who Was a Scientist. This is about Joseph Priestley, who was a Unitarian scientist and minister who also fled to America, as did the Universalist John Murray. He arrived in New York in 1794, so after Murray, and helped found the First Unitarian Church of Philadelphia. So although Priestley was a Unitarian and Murray was a Universalist, they were both persecuted by being part of this dissenters group. So, Rosemary.
Well, new grandma, a new grandma, and a new name for a grandma. I'm from Germany, so for people there call their grandmas Oma. You can call me Oma Rosemary if you want. So So the minister who was a scientist. Now, do you know what most people like best about drinks, like Coca-Cola or Sprite or Soda Pop? They like the bubbles. Yeah, well, you were going to tell me. What do you like best? People like the bubbles and the fizz. And it was a Unitarian minister in England, Joseph Priestley, who experimented with gases in his laboratory and made the very first fizzy drinks. So we could say he invented soda pop without caffeinated. It's hard to imagine a minister messing around in a science lab, isn't it? But that's just what Priestley did back in the mid-1700s, so like 300 years ago. He was a curious person who asked lots and lots of questions about how things worked in the universe and about religion, too. But in those days, asking questions about religion was a dangerous thing, especially for a minister, because it was against the law, can you believe that, to believe or teach anything that was different from what the Church of England taught. And that church taught that Jesus was the real Son of God and that all humans were born sinful. Do you know what sinful is? Well, they were born with evil inside their hearts to begin with. And so Priestley was not sure he could believe that. And he decided a person could very well believe that Jesus was a wonderful teacher without believing he was the real Son of God sent to earth to save sinful people. The Unitarian churches of that time where Priestley worked were poor and small, and they were even attacked by people who were afraid of his freedom-loving ideas. So for a few years, Priestley left church work and opened his own school where students were encouraged to ask questions about everything and work on their own ideas and experiments. Pretty good school, it sounds like. But while some thought his teaching was very good, the school never made enough money to support him and his family, so it had to close. Finally, in 1773, Priestley lucked out. He got a job as a private tutor and librarian with a very wealthy English aristocratic family who liked Priestley and gave him space and money for his experiments. And during those years, Priestley wrote about 150 books about air, electricity, and a lot of things that you learn in school today. And one of the important things we remember was he discovered oxygen. Some of you know that already. It's the stuff that we need to breathe in, that we need to live, really. Without oxygen, we can't live. When that job ended, Priestley took another job as minister. And this time at a church where people agreed with his free religious ideas. He was happy there for 10 years, but then the infighting between the traditional church leaders, the old-timey ones, and the new ones got so bad that at one point, you won't believe this, an angry mob burned down his house, his church, his library, and his lab. And in the end, he and his wife just barely escaped with their lives. So obviously, it was high time to leave England and this possessive kind of church and move to the U.S. where his two adult sons lived. He did have two sons. And they settled in a small town, Northumberland, fairly close to Philadelphia. And it took more than 4 years to build a home and a new lab. And during that time, Priestley traveled to Philadelphia to set up a Unitarian congregation. But he never accepted the job as a minister that he was offered there. And today we remember him as a founder of Unitarianism in America, basically because of his work with that Philadelphia church. Now, the last years of his life, Priestley spent doing what he liked best, experiments, and interestingly writing about the history of Christianity. But science and religion remained his two great life's passions. And he died at age 70 in 1804. And a little afterthought here, if your mom and pop tell you not to drink so much soda pop because it's unhealthy, well, you might remind them that it was, after all, invented by the great Unitarian Universalist Joseph Priestley.
Our program this morning is being presented by Barbara Park.
Thanks for doing that. Okay. Today we're going to, first of all, I hope you came prepared to sing. Because today we're going to talk briefly about a few of the founders of Universalism in North America, recount a few stories, and sing several hymns, which you have in your packets, all of which illustrate their gospel of love, their yearning spirit, and their social prophecy. Though some of the words sing of another time than ours, the Universalist founders pioneered the questioning mind and the loving and caring spirit, the keen sense of justice and equality that we prize today and have framed in the principles and purposes of our association. First of all, John Murray, who we've had talked about before, is considered by most to be the father of Universalism in North America. He became the minister to preach what's considered the first Universalist service, and he became the minister of the First Universalist Church of Gloucester, Massachusetts in 1779. It's interesting because that congregation won two landmark victories for religious freedom and the separation of church and state, and I think we don't often acknowledge or even know about this. There was an established church in Massachusetts. Murray and his congregation sued to get the right of congregations to be free of financially supporting the state church and the right of independent churches to ordain their own clergy and grant them the right to perform marriages. So this is stuff that, you know, we take for granted. You know, there was an established church. You've got to be kidding. While he was in Gloucester, he met and married the talented author, essayist, and woman of letters, Judith Sargent. And together they spread the idea that all are equally dear to God. There were other pioneer ministers who preached Universalism in the late 1700s along the New England coast, some journeying as far as Canada. These folks were evangelists. We don't think of UUs as being evangelical, but they definitely were. They preached, they traveled around as revivalists, articulate, thoughtful, passionate. They preached God's universal love of all people in all places, times, and conditions. We're going to start singing one of the tunes, and you're going to be familiar with all of these tunes, because in the 18th and 19th century, authors wrote the text in a meter of a tune that they were familiar with. But the hymn books, when they were printed, only had the texts. This was true before 1850. They just assumed everybody knew the tunes. So we seldom know exactly which tune the author had in mind when he or she wrote the songs. So when they developed this program, what they did is they took hymns that were programmed mainly set to common tunes that were already composed by the date when the text was written, so that they could have could have been what they used. And they're all tunes that are very familiar to us today. So the next thing we're going to sing is number 2 in your packet, which is by John Murray, Go Forth, My Friends. Well, forth they went. The work was arduous, the trials great, the harvest of souls heartening. One of these men was Hosea Ballou, whose words we read for the chalice lighting. Hosea Ballou was a self-educated farm boy from Vermont who became a forceful and progressive speaker for the Universalist cause. In 1805, he published a treatise on atonement, asserting that God was a loving father rather than a punitive judge, that Jesus was an exalted human being rather than a member of the Trinity. So these folks were also Unitarian in their theology, and that sin was personal rather than inherited. He trained generations of ministers, and thousands came to hear him speak. In 1807, the Universalist Convention charged Hosea Ballou and 3 other ministers with writing a book of new hymns that would unite mind and spirit in singing the Universalist gospel. 1 year later, they published a hymnal for 75 cents, leather-bound. It contained 400 original hymns by the 4 editors. So now we'll sing one of those hymns by Ballou, foretelling the glories which will come to earth when all creation hears and responds to this new truth. So we'll sing number 3, When God Descends to Earth. Well, the hope was millennial and the spirit contagious. Universalism spread north, south, and west past the Alleghenies, removing the fear of hell and bringing the hope of universal salvation. While Unitarianism spread from city to city, Universalism spread everywhere. Preachers took the gospel on horseback to cities, towns, hamlets, and crossroads. I'm skipping a bunch here. So they went from Canada down to New Orleans. The last evangelical circuit rider was Quillen Shin, who died in 1907, so this is pretty modern, at the age of 62, and it's said that his last missionary trip was to South Carolina, and in the year, it's reported between 1904 and 1905, alone, he traveled more than 38,000 miles, 900 of them on horseback or by foot. Russell Miller observed that Shin brought hundreds of individuals to Universalism, was responsible for building at least 40 churches, and recruiting at least 30 people for the ministry. Wow. So these people got around. The traveling preachers were a form of entertainment during the 1800s and the early 1900s. Universalists were known for having studied the Bible and early realized that the Bible was written by many people and in some parts carried more historical weight than others. So they were very interested in the Bible. One example of this traveling preachers was David Levitt, and he traveled the far corners of Ontario, challenging Orthodox preachers to debates that lasted 2 or 3 days. People loved this religious sport and flocked to hear it. On one occasion, Levitt, with his prodigious biblical memory and skill at quoting the proof text, down 4 Methodist preachers in a row. Okay, now we'll sing a particularly poetic hymn written by Alexander Greaton Laurie, a Scotsman who preached in Ontario starting in 1843. He described universalism as sprinkled like fleecy clouds on the bosom of a speckled sky. So we'll read sing number four, The Golden Cloud. Well, these early people were certainly not in, there was not unanimity among the early Universalists. Universalists were not of one mind yesterday any more than Unitarian Universalists are of one mind today. The independence that brought Universalists out of Orthodoxy resulted in a variety of beliefs. The death and glory Universalists held that everyone, no matter how evil, went immediately to heaven after death. Whereas the restorationists clear that the world did not provide sufficient comeuppance to the wayward, believed that a God of justice would mete out some purgatorial punishment before the final restoration of all souls with the divine. Interestingly enough, this debate basically went forward until Universalists, you know, in the end, in the Unitarian Universalist tradition, kind of stopped believing in heaven altogether. there was a very hot debate. And one of these controversies was aired very publicly. Thomas Whitmore was a Universalist minister who edited and published the Universalist Trumpet, which became very influential in shaping Universalist thought. He preached the simple gospel of God's unfailing love of all people in all time, places, and conditions. And he butted head with Abner Kneeland, who was the most radical of Universalist ministers and ultimately left the Universalist fold. Kneeland disdained social mores, preferring naturalistic and personal quests for truth. And we'll identify with a lot of what Kneeland said. In 1831, after several stormy ministries, he went to Boston and founded the first Society of Free Inquirers and a newspaper called the Boston Investigator. Whitmore challenged Kneeland to a newspaper debate in their two publications. Kneeland declared that Universalist belief in God was a figment of their imaginations. Universalist belief in Jesus was nothing but myth and fable. Universalist faith in eternal life, false. Kneeland ended up being arrested for blasphemy, which was still on the books in Massachusetts at that time, although it was certainly against the Constitution. And after four different trials, he was convicted, although there was a lot of support from the local clergy of both Unitarian and Universalist ilk. The prosecutor and the judge were Unitarians. But they convicted him anyway. He spent 60 days in prison, and when he was released, he left for Iowa, where he founded a small utopian community named Salubria. Today, we would not find his ideas shocking. He believed in equal treatment of all people, both under the law as well as by society. By supporting such controversial ideas as divorce rights for women, married women keeping their own names and property, he refused to condemn interracial marriages and was in favor of birth control. Now, this is before 1850. Okay, the next thing we're gonna sing is one of Kneeland's hard-hitting hymns. So this have a very different feel in its words from some of the other little happy, joyful ones. And it's number six in your packet, A View of Christendom.
And everywhere,
Well, we're already working short on time, so I'm going to skip the next one, which was for the love of Sunday school. But just to say that that the Universalists very early were interested in the education of young. In 1787, the first catechism for Universalist children was written, and then in the second quarter of the 19th century, Universalists were strongly in support of the transition from private schools to tax-supported public schools, and very strongly supported the separation of church and state in these schools, and worked very hard to keep public schools non-sectarian, where no religious instruction would be permitted. Bit ahead of their time. Universalist women were among the most ardent and prolific of the hymn writers. The Carey sisters and Phoebe Hannaford represented that numerous clan. The Carey sisters' literary soirees in New York apartment drew some of the most famous authors and public figures of their time. They gathered to the unknown, especially women, who they guided and encouraged. So we'll sing a short hymn by Alice Carey that was published in Services for Congregational Worship in 1877. It's number 9 in your packet. Another literary Universalist was Phoebe Hannaford, poet, lecturer, and author of about 24 books. She wrote in midlife, quote, "All my books have been prepared among pressing duties of a domestic, editorial, and pastoral character, but God called me to preach." And preach she did. All of these women, Universalist women did, not only about Universalism, but women's rights and hopes for children. These women forged the trials of life into poems, songs, hymns that move the hearts of all women and men alike. And I think we're going to skip her hymn, which was called, well, okay, we'll sing. Okay, number 10, it's short. Number 10.
Cast my bread upon the waters, I will bow to floating sand. Mountains shall dance in the harvest, save us so with liberal hand.
Bounteous the harvest, perhaps, but the harvest of social reform was important too. As early as 1790, the Philadelphia Convention of Universalists addressed the social issues of its day, just as we do in General Assembly today. They passed pioneering resolutions opposing war, slavery, and compulsory oath-taking, and affirmed arbitration in place of litigation. On the issue of slavery, they reasoned that since people were all equal in heaven, they had best practice getting along as equals here on earth. Other Universalists were working for temperance, women's rights, prison reform, the rehabilitation of prisoners, and the abolition of capital punishment.
Still today.
Still today, yes. We're going to skip. No, I guess we won't. Another reform movement was the Utopian Communities. And in 1842, one of the first and most successful ones, the Hopedale Community, was founded by Aidan Ballou. You'll recognize that in association with the Alcott family. Let's see, but I'm trying to skip. So we're going to sing his hymn of peace, which is 166 in our hymn books. The years are coming, speed them onward. Okay, we are rapidly running out of time, which is too bad because we have lots of other things that we could talk about. But there's one more hymn that I really want to do some of, and that's 100 Years Hence, which is number 13, written by Frances Dana Gage. And she was a champion of the cause of which most of the women were doing, abolition, women's rights, and temperance. We're going to just do a couple. So in 1850, she petitioned the Ohio State Legislature to remove two words of power and privilege from their state constitution. The words were white and male. Okay, so we'll sing. Oh, let's see.
One and four.
Yeah, we're certainly not going to do.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Well, okay. How about? Okay, and then, but I would suggest that you read the words afterwards because it's really interesting what things she prophesizes will happen, and what things actually happen versus what things didn't happen. So we'll just sing hymns or verse 1 and 4 at popular request. But definitely read them, because they're just a stitch. Maybe we should give this to the Congress. Okay, we have to stop. We have time for just like maybe one question, and then we will carry on at that point. But there's chance for a couple of more of these wonderful old songs. Right, there was definitely a strong movement of these, what they called dissenting churches. In England, there was a man named Raleigh who was preaching the Universalist gospel. And that's who John Murray heard and was converted from. I don't know if he was Presbyterian or what he was, to the Universalist philosophy.
This was the time of Thomas Paine. I'm sure they knew his writing.
Oh, yes.
He had to leave England, too.
Right, Thomas Paine. So the Church of England was trying very hard to squash all of these dissenting, both political and religious viewpoints. It was. And in Germany, there was a group, the free thinkers, who were very much pushing against the clergy of the day. And then in 1848, many of them were pushed out of Germany on fear of imprisonment and death, and immigrated to the United States, which is where we get our church in Sauk City, that was formed by those people at that time and is still, was taken under the Unitarian fold in the late 40s, only when the speaker discovered that there were no other freethinker groups that he could find. And so they joined the Unitarians, even though they found the Unitarians way too conservative. I'll be around afterwards. You can ask questions then. We're going to have our offertory now, and the choir is going to sing the offertory, and it's called the Resurrection Hymn. And I want you, as the composer of both the words and music is Thomas Whitmore, which, as we said, they were usually sent to common tunes. So the fact that he wrote this music is unusual. It was published in 1842. in a book called The Conference Hymns. And picture you're at some sort of revivalist event. You know, one of those three-day tent meetings. The closing words, which again, we're quoting from the famous quotation from John Murray that we heard a few weeks ago, because this so wonderfully captures the early spirit of the Universalists. Go out into the highways and byways. Give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but uncover it. Let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and everlasting love of God.